This is a production of Cornell University.
I am delighted to read with Paul and with Dennis, and I'm happy to be at Cornell this semester. Although I have to admit, I felt slightly terrified when Stephanie said this was an event to mark the beginning of winter. Tell me it's not just starting. This is not true. This can't be true. I am going to start with a winter poem, and it's one that wants to think about the behavior of groups, of flocks in particular, and the peculiar way that groups of creatures, such as birds, seem to make decisions without apparent consultation. And suddenly, an intelligence acts in a particular way without any sort of visible to us mechanism of such intelligence at work. And I have to tell you that the poem, which the specific flock in this poem is a group of chickadees, those birds that will stay around through the winter, even here. There is a one word referring to these chickadees which I cannot say to you as I read the poem, because it isn't a word, but a little explosion of punctuation. And it's intended to represent the sound that a bird would make noticing you. If you could hear that. Now, before I read this poem, I have to tell you, this is a very peculiar occasion for me, because this is my new and selected poems, and this is fresh from the bindery, so there are exactly two copies of this book in the world. It's a rarity. And I have never read from it before, so this feels like launching into something new. The poem is called Flit. Dart. An idea arcs the cold, then a clutch of related thoughts. Slim branches don't even flicker with the weight of what's landed. Animate alphabet whizzing past our faces, a black and white hurry, as if a form of notation accompanied our walk, a little ahead of us and a bit behind. If we could see their trajectory, if their trace remained in the winter air, what a tunnel they'd figure. Skein of quick vectors above our heads, a fierce braid, improvised. Their decisions, the way one makes poetry from syntax, unpredictable, resolving to wild regularity. Thought has to flit to describe it. Speech has to try that hurry. A scaffolding, a kind of argument about being numerous. Thread and rethread. A light. Study. We might be carrying crumbs. We're not. I wish. Their small heads cock. They lift, no visible effort, as if flight were the work of the will only. Light a bit further along, and though they're silent, it seems you could hear the minute repeating registers of their attention. The here you are, yes, here you, yes. Pronoun reference unclear. Who looks at us? An aerial association of a dozen subjectivities, or a singular self wearing this snowy afternoon, 12 pair of wings. Collectivity of sparks, sparking collectivity. Say live resides not inside feathers or skin, but in the whizzing medium. No third person. Sharp, clear globe of January. And we, the 14 of us, the thinking taking place. We is instances of alertness. Grammar, help me. Mind in the ringing day. A little of us ahead and a bit behind, and all that action barely disturbs the air. My work has been involved for many years with the presence of creatures, with animal company of one kind or another. And I'm going to shift away from poetry and read you a little prose from this book, Dog Years, which came out last year. It's a memoir of 16 years of living with two big retrievers. The part that you're going to hear concerns my dog Arden, who was a Newfoundland lab mix, and he is about to make his first visit to a kennel in central Vermont in the late 1980s. One kennel we visit seems like a jail for pets, with concrete floors and brilliant fluorescent lights and awful metal doors that bang and reverberate through the metal walls. The search for an acceptable kennel isn't an easy thing, but there's a week we have to be away. A friend from school recommends Arlene's, a place perched way back on a dirt road on a hill above the college, in a zone of trailers and odd little manufactured homes. My colleague says, it might not be quite what you're used to. We call, then go for a visit. Arlene is a wide woman in a flowered dress who seems to have a bit of difficulty standing. She says, my leg's been bugging me, but Junior can take you out to the kennel. Junior is a thick fellow, arms and legs are the same size, and his head seems made of identical material, as if he were built of tubes of clay, all extruded from the same pipe. We walk across the muddy patches and the thin grass out back to a row of pens made of wire fencing, roofless, each one with a little wooden house inside. One pen has several of the ramshackle structures for the more social. It looks like the canine version of a town in a John Waters movie. But we try to remind ourselves that what we seek in a kennel might not be the things that would please a dog. And Junior does seem affectionate with the animals, and the creatures wiggling their butts in the pens are completely fine. When Arden arrives, he appears to find the place delightful. He runs up to the edge of the cages, greeting the inhabitants, much tail wagging, sniffing, friendly little barks. We're wretchedly nervous about leaving him. I suddenly feel very gay and very middle class. But he shows no signs of being the least bit bothered. And we're disciplining ourselves not to look back too much as we walk away, letting him be absorbed in his new social life in the big damp pen. Of course, we call Arlene from San Francisco a couple of days into the trip. She's as laconic as an old Vermonter could ever be. She says, he's just fine. What I want, naturally, are some details, but I don't quite know how to ask for them. So he's okay? He's doing just fine. I try again. He's adjusting okay? Pause. Arlene calls out, Junior. Another pause. Shuffly noise. Phone bumped or dropped. Muffled words then. How's that new black dog? Muffled word. She gets back on the receiver. Junior says he's just fine. I have no choice but to believe, though I also can't help but imagine Arlene rolling her eyes. At last we're back and make the drive from the airport straight up Arlene's dusty, gravelly road. The noise of our car pulling into the driveway rouses Junior, who emerges and leads us out back. Arden's in the big pen by himself, as all the other dogs seem to have gone home. He comes bounding out of his doghouse, and when Junior opens the door to the pen, he jumps straight up in the air, arcing his body like a leaping fish, the picture of joy. Junior retrieves the blanket we've left with him, which feels very damp, as indeed does Arden. I look back and see that the doghouse has a gaping black hole in the roof. Arden's been sleeping in the rain all week. But in fact, he seems none the worse for wear, perhaps even refreshed by the experience, as happy and eager as he's ever been, though we don't ever go back to Arlene's. It's 15 years later when Paul and I drive Arden on fall weekends down to a little house Paul's parents own on the Jersey Shore. When we pull off the Garden State Parkway at the exit, Arden sits up in the back of the station wagon, excited, head to the glass, nostrils pulsing in the salt air. At the house, he's in heaven. There's a small grassy yard that fronts onto a lagoon, a world of things to watch. Arden's happiness is to lie in the grass, alert to seagulls and egrets, to passing boats, to rippling water. Across the canal, they're building condos smack out onto the wetlands, so there's an occasional truck, a bulldozer flattening reeds. He hardly has to walk at all if he doesn't choose to. It's hard for him these days, and a whole world seems to offer itself for his inspection. Eventually, he falls asleep out in the grass, and in a while wakes up and watches again. He's so pleased with his situation that he doesn't want to come in that evening. So we let him stay there, sleeping in the twilight. We don't have the heart to wake him, but at 3 a.m, we're roused by a crashing lightning and then a wild downpour like gravel poured onto the roof of the house. Suddenly, I'm awake enough to think, my God, he must be miserable. I pull on some shorts and run out into the storm, only to find him so deeply, completely asleep, he seems he might be sinking into the earth. He's soaked to the bone. I say his name, nothing. I stroke him, no response. Now I'm soaked in the cold rain too. I put my hand on his ribs to make sure he's breathing, which he is, but he has gone so far into the bliss of sleeping in the grass beside the dark lagoon that I can't wake him at all. And this is a dog who didn't even like to go for a walk in the rain. I don't know that in a few minutes after I've given up and run back into the house to wrap myself in a towel and shiver and shake off the water as if I were myself a large soaking dog, he'll stumble back into awareness, wake up enough to hobble to the door so that he can have a towel drying too. Just now, as I am bending over the absolutely still black body gleaming in the flashes of lightning, he suddenly seems to me the image of King Lear, the mad old man on the moor, fallen, intensely vulnerable, the image of all our aging, helpless in the storm. And I'm the worried fool, trying to rouse the tragic, failing king. But perhaps I dramatize. As I have been known to do, I could also have read his deep, dreamless sleep in the rain as a memory of Arlene's, of lovely nights of youth in a fragrant field, in good company, where the rain must have brought to the sleeping animals new fragrances of its own. My colleague who said it might not be quite what you're used to is actually here this evening after all those years. So it's wonderful. So this book contains a batch of new poems, and the new poems are called Theories and Apparitions as a group. And I wanted to read for you one of the apparitions. The apparitions are appearances, rather oblique or odd appearances of poets of the past. And all I need to tell you about this apparition is that it contains a quote from Charles Darwin, and I am delighted to tell you that the quote is real. Apparition. Oracular pair. This peacock perched in a plywood roost at the garden center, magnificent behind a wire fence marked with his name, Homer, and hand-lettered instructions, "Don't provoke me." He's the provocation. Of what use the wrought extravagance he's not just now displaying? Darwin. The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. No reason on earth, even eons of increments, would conspire to this. And is the peahen that hard to attract? Requiring an arc of nervous gleams, 100 shining animals symmetrically peering from the dim primeval woods. But if Homer argues by his mere presence for creation, his deity's a little hysteric. Rampant attitude contained in all that glory. Did he who made the lamb make this imperious metallic topknot shivering above an emerald field of anodized aluminum, while Homer blinks and flicks his actual eyes from side to side? And then the epic trombone slide from Mars cry. No human throat can mime. Is that why it stops the heart? Just before he condescends to unfurl the archaic poem of his tale. So that poem, I might suggest to you that one of the obsessions in this book is the nature of beauty, what it means to us. How we attempt to understand, name it, and to understand it, and to theorize it. This particular poem also takes up that concern, and it's set in Jersey City, on the edge of Manhattan. And one winter morning, Paul and I were actually on our way someplace. We were driving through Jersey City, and we came upon a beauty shop, which apparently had just been set aflame. And, you know, the alarm was ringing, the smoke was pouring out the window, but there was nobody there at all. House of Beauty. In Jersey City, on Tonelli Avenue, the House of Beauty is burning. On a Sunday morning in January, under the chilly shadow of the Pulaski Skyway, the House of Beauty is burning. Who lobbed the fire bottle through the glass, in among the creams and thrones, the helmets and clippers and combs? Who set the House of Beauty burning? In the dark recess beside the sink, where heads lay back to be laved, under the perfected heads rode along the walls, the hopeful photographs of possibility darken. Now that the House of Beauty is burning. The skyway beetles in the ringing coal, trestle arcing the steel river and warehouses, truck lots and Indian groceries, a new plume of smoke joining the others, billow of dark thought rising from the broken forehead of the House of Beauty. An omission almost too small to notice just now. Alarm still ringing, the flames new launched on their project of ruining an effort at pleasure. Glass jutting like cracked ice in the window frame. No one inside. The fire department on the way. All things by nature, wrote Virgil, are ready to get worse. No surprise then that the House of Beauty is burning. But whatever happens, however far these fires proceed, reducing history to powder, whatever the House of Beauty made is untouchable now. Nothing can undo so many heads made lovely, or at least acceptable. So much shapelessness given what are called permanence, though nothing holds a fixed form. Bring on the flames. What does it matter if the house is burning? Propose a new beauty, perennially unhoused. Neither the lost things nor the fire itself, but the objects in their dresses of disaster. Anything clothed in its own passage, Padded vinyl chair burst into smoky tongues. Lucite helmet sagged to a new version of its dome. Our black bridge, a charred rainbow on iron legs, two ruby eyes glowering from its crown. If beauty is burning, what could you save? The house of beauty is a house of flames. The poem owes a little debt to Jean Cocteau, who was, once an interviewer asked him, if your apartment was on fire, what would you save? And he said, I would save the flames. Okay, well, I'm going to end with a very new poem. This is set on Fire Island, where I spend every summer. And Fire Island is a long barrier island on the south shore of Long Island. And the village where I live, Fire Island Pines, has been a gay resort for, 50 years now, a place of very particular character. And there are two things you need to know about the Pines for this poem. One is that there are no cars there, no motor vehicles. And this turns out to be a very happy situation for wildlife. So we have wonderful deer, birds, these animal presences. Fire Island has an extremely codified social schedule. And so every afternoon at 7 o'clock, there is an event called Tea Dance. Nobody dances. You drink and stand around. But there is this sort of expectation that you go. If you don't go, you feel peculiar, that you're not part of social life. And it's very strange at 7 o'clock to look out onto the boardwalks, which go across the dunes, and just see these rows of men proceeding, as if without will, to tea dance. A crippled king. Hard by our fence in tea dance light, he seemed the very model of his kind. A buck in velvet at the garden rim, bronze lightly shagged, split thumbs of antlers budding. That odd way deer hold extra still, as though there were degrees of stasis. We were objects of his regal, mild regard. Did I really say tea? Measure the afternoon by a bar event? Here it's a fixed point of the day. Our island's scattered men gather near 7 and stand with cocktails in the thick of buzzing bodies, intent in quick talk, though their subtle eyes don't miss a trick. Here, after all, tea dance started. Wise strategy for an island with no street lamps. Boardwalks pitching along the dunes. Scary after dark. Far better navigated before nightfall. He stepped toward us. An unexpected lurch. And then we saw. One front leg merely tapered to a whisper. Like the torso of a cartoon ghost. He gladly accepted a carrot, a gesture plainly familiar. Where else could he have lived? No cars, no hunting, sympathetic visitors who'd bring him kitchen scraps, nothing to trouble but cameras with their automatic flash, or dance music booming from some big box rental, and ticks. He wore a small crown of swollen passengers between two brave ears where he could not bite them, and no other deer provided the seemingly secret grooming they perform. He exhaled a small puff of carrot-scented wind, handsome face expressive, not much in doubt of the human. We'd see him evenings up the walk, always alone, browsing the cranberry bog. He hauled himself through gardens, intently working tufts of grass, big muscled shoulder pulling him ahead, unfinished left leg hanging, curl of fur over a round of bone. I learned to appreciate the deft accomplishment of hoof, that elongated blue-black shoe of cloven carbon. Without it, he was wildly awkward, though he'd learned to do with what he had. I brought him celery. He liked corn silk, but not the husks, and seemed to prefer the leaves of sassafras with their faint spice scent. Something, did I imagine it, seemed to pass across his gaze as he took them in, lower jaw working horizontally, a faint tearing sound. Then he'd take his tongue to my hands. They startled me at first, those sucking lips around my fingertips, careful, as if he were grooming another of his kind. I felt I could lay my hand on that long slope of a forehead or stroke behind the ears, but whatever was left of his wildness needed to stand, if only on three legs. I tried to name him to myself, but he wanted no word from me. More likely, I should be subject to this monarch of Holly, hobbling prince of Shadblow Grove, our island's crippled king. When July mounted to its zenith, his antlers turned in oddly. The other's racks spread to balancing wings, while his two chandelier arms, each mirroring the other, grew inward, a parody of symmetry. Wouldn't they collide? What grows in toward itself? How can it live? How find company among its kind? I went looking, spent daylilies in hand, but no sign of him. If a white tail flashed, it wasn't his. Paul said he just has to appear. You can't will him to show up. Out there, somewhere, in the leaf realms of August, lurching alone through all that glory. In the distance, the party thundered, season climbing to its apogee. Big speakers dragged out to the beach where midnight lapped the snow fence, and dreamers swayed and danced, held one another or themselves. And though the dance floor's artificial mist tried to complicate the twittering skyfield of laser lights, a real fog put the false to shame. In November, Paul saw him grazing a thicket by the yellowing bog. Not again. Then, late winter, a hushed, not quite scrutable rumor on the ferry. A deer's head floating in the bay, wreathed with flowers. Evidence of ritual murder, Santeria, never to be mentioned again. Bad for business. Knowledge no summer renter required. My friend, I feel I have some right, strangely, to call him that. I tried not to think so, but he could hardly flee. We'll never know. But listen, I saw my own severed head slip to the floor. A paltry, glazed thing, open eye looking up toward my subjectivity, as if through a bloody gel. So much for the notion you can't die in a dream. I was the witness I've always been. What difference did a head make? Though everything, once, my phantom king, to you. Likewise beheaded, would you allow me now to do what I would not when you were living, and take in my two hands those bone branches, sturdy as oars. Can't I take hold of you now, in the water, in the dark, floating in the gift of flowers, not lurching, firmly, steady, easy. Now, guide me out of the story, Spirit. I don't know where it is you lead, but I believe you must have been weary of that form, as I grow weary of my head and leave it behind, a cast-off thing, and lend my body to your severed crown. Thank you.